Welcome back, and joining us now is Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute, MISES.org. They're over there in Auburn, Alabama. These are the free market guys, and we are a free market network. Dr. Mark, how are you doing today?
Very good, Alan. It's great to be back on the program. Beautiful Monday morning here in Auburn, Alabama.
Beautiful Monday morning here in Atlanta, Georgia, even though we're 2 hours away, different time zones. I wonder how that happened. But, Mark, this weekend, actually it was this morning, one of the other shows that airs on our network had a fellow who's a very likable guy, and they were talking about this notion of a flexible currency and how returning to a gold or silver standard or the bimetal standard we started this nation with would somehow or another be bad for the economy. Can we talk about that briefly?
Well, Alan, I think it's the central question that nobody's talking about because it relates not to just prices, but it also relates to the business cycle. It relates to income distribution. And, of course, it's having a flexible currency is the key reason why the U.S. government can run huge budget deficits and run up a huge national debt and undertake a costly foreign war. So I think it's the central question of today that if you watch the mainstream media or listen to the mainstream media, you're not going to even see the question raised. So it's only at places like Mises.org and your program and other programs on your network where you're going to even see the question raised.
Well, I know that a number of the shows, in fact, probably two-thirds of our lineup, the problem is the flexible currency. And by flexible currency, what we're talking about is paper money, fiat currency backed by nothing. That's what they mean by flexible currency. And it always seems to flex in one direction, inflation. But, you know, and then I heard the old, well, there's no way we could return to the gold standard because there's just not enough money out there. And, you know, I wanted to say it's not the quantity of money, but the quality of money. So let's say we went back to a less flexible period, 1964, when we last had silver, our constitutional money for the money. A gallon of gasoline was a quarter. We always use that one. Well, in today's, if you can buy almost a gallon and a half now with a 1964 quarter. It's not the quantity of money. It is the quality of money.
Yeah, basically in 1964 was the last time the U.S. issued silver coins in the U.S. Of course, now traditionally we were on the gold standard where the dollar was defined as 1/20th of an ounce of gold. And then the money that circulated actually was silver, which could be exchanged for a dollar and then ultimately exchanged for an ounce of gold if you wanted to do that kind of thing. And, you know, other than the wartime periods when we went off the gold standard, basically the purchasing power of our money, looking at the broad spectrum of goods available in the economy, was relatively stable over that entire period. So you'd get a lot of volatility in some financial markets and the international purchasing power of the dollar, but domestically things were very stable, very serene, and it was, you know, you think of the gold standard as somewhat inflexible, but actually it creates the international flexibility because it allows for international adjustments of in currency while leaving domestic markets rather tranquil. And so, you know, your wage rates, even if you had the same job and earned the same wages through your entire career, your purchasing power of your wages and of your savings would increase slightly every year. So you wouldn't even need a pay raise to become more and more successful and have a greater ability to purchase and a greater wealth over time when you had that kind of solid, stable, sound money system.
Well, and let's briefly, just for background, we started off with the silver standard with the Coinage Act of 1792. A dollar was defined as 371.8 grains of silver. And then we had the big debate in the late 1890s, which brought us up to the Coinage Act of 1902, when the dollar was redefined as 1/20th an ounce of gold.
That's right. The U.S. Constitution puts the in the hands of Congress the authority to determine the weight of money in terms of gold and silver. And they extended their own power, I think, somewhat unconstitutionally to be able to go beyond that constitutional authority.
Now, this is probably, I know Dr. Murphy, another Mises fellow, he's an expert on all these panics, but how well versed are you on the Panic of 1837?
Well, I certainly know what was going on.
Well, just the reason I bring that up, I apologize for interrupting, I just like to frame these questions sometimes. A lot of people point to 1837 as the all the justification we needed to create the creature from Jekyll Island, the Federal Reserve, our fourth rendition of a central bank. I know most of the Keynesians did not like Andrew Jackson because he killed off the second bank of the U.S., which was technically our third central bank. But what exactly happened in the Panic of 1837?
Well, as you suggest, we had a central the Second Bank of the United States was in existence in this time. It began with its charter in February of 1817, I believe, and it lasted until January 1836, and it was given a charter by the U.S. government, and the U.S. government was a major owner of the bank, and along with a lot of wealthy people. And basically what happened was between the Second Bank of the U.S. as well as the Bank of England, they basically set off a bubble or a boom in the economy during the 1830s. And the Second Bank of the U.S. Had an expansionary monetary policy along with the Bank of England. And as a result, you had a major expansion of debt in the U.S. economy. But Andrew Jackson saw the Second Bank of the U.S., of the United States, as dangerous, and that it was helping affluent people in both the U.S. and Europe at the expense of the little guy who Andrew Jackson sort of represented. And so he undertook a war on this Hamiltonian-type national bank and was able to defeat the rechartering of the Second Bank of the U.S. In 1836, and so basically the bank had to come to a close, and we had to go back onto basically a hard money, gold and silver standard system during this political fighting that went on. And as a result, of course, there had to undergo a period of liquidation at this time, and so, you know, the economy had to go through a corrective process just as it has in the past. And so the two big panics, pre-Civil War panics in the U.S., were directly related to the First and Second Bank of the U.S. and how those two institutions led to an overexpansion of debt in the economy, which produced booms or bubbles in the economy, but those things couldn't be sustained. And inevitably would have had to undergo a period of correction and of liquidation of those debts. And that's basically what happened in the Panic of 1837.
Well, so to cite the Panic of 1837 as justification for yet another privately owned central bank then is just totally misleading.
That's right. And, you know, we find out these things after the fact. Historians inevitably go back. And after institutions have been replaced and they sift through the details, they find out that, well, these institutions were inherently problematic. They caused a lot more problems than anybody originally thought about. And so, you know, only recently, for example, have the National Banking Acts of the Civil War period, in which the Lincoln administration and the Republican legislature put national regulations over the banking structure from 1862 on up until the enactment of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. and that all of those post-Civil War panics were directly a result of the pyramid system that was inherent in the National Banking Acts, and that, you know, major mainstream economists have looked back at that period and said that a system couldn't have been devised under worse conditions, you know, to set up a system that created the worst possible conditions where the system was set up basically to fail and to experience these periodic panics in the financial system because of the pyramiding scheme that was inherent in the reserve structure of banks, which greatly, by the way, were a big benefit for the big New York City banks, but were highly detrimental to money and banking in the southern states and in the western states.
Mark, back to the notion of this flexible currency, I like to do this, a little bit of it every day. I graduated from high school in 1972. And in 1972, silver was $1.50 an ounce. And the average wage was $7,134, or another way of saying it, it was 4,756 silver dollars, which shows you just in seven brief years, because we still had silver coins in 1960 through 1964. But in the span of seven brief years, the dollar had already lost a third of its value. But what this flexible currency has done for us today, if you were still making, if you didn't get a penny's raise since the day I graduated from high school in 1972, and I was still earning 4,756 silver dollars, my wage would be $79,092 in this fiat currency. The average wage last year was $50,000 in America. That is a 37% decline. There went the middle class. Am I seeing this correctly?
No, I think it's very true. I think that the current system creates greater wealth disparities, and that a gold and silver system creates more of a leveling prospect. It creates greater opportunities for low-income, low-education people, disadvantaged groups. They have more of incentive to save. They have more incentive to work. They have more of incentive to build up and grow over time. And so there's a great leveling process that sound money creates, just because it itself is stable in value and actually increases in purchasing power slightly over time, as well as there's an incentive to save, there's an incentive to work. But in today's system, you know, the whole thing is rigged against people rising up through the ranks. I mean, there's still a great deal of income mobility in the U.S. It's still true that people in the bottom 20% can rise into this top 20% over the course of a lifetime. So there's still a lot of flexibility, but there's much less so, and particularly less so since we went off the gold standard in 1971. Let's just put it this way. The central bank issues, they buy government bonds from the big New York banks who make money on that. They, in turn, these big banks have reserves, which they can lend out to make more loans. And as a consequence, you know, it's like going into the bakery business where the government provides you with free flour, free sugar, and pays your power bill. I mean, it's very easy to make money in big financial institutions. You can get a lot of leverage in your institution and make just an awful lot of money. And so the current system today favors the big New York banks. It favors Wall Street. It favors hedge funds. It favors high finance, and it attracts, unfortunately, it attracts a lot of talent into those industries, which is basically not producing real goods and services. I mean, there's a role for finance in an economy in terms of matching up savers with borrowers and investors, but the current system, the money goes all the way to the top, and so as a consequence of that, there's been a dramatic stretching of income distribution in the U.S., where the wealthiest 1%, have a greater wealth than the bottom two-thirds of the income distribution chain. And so I think the central bank is the primary cause, and the lack of a sound money system in gold and silver are the primary causes of this widening and these great disparities in income and wealth distribution, because they're basically providing the raw ingredient for free, basically, to these large financial institutions. And so if you look at that top 1% of income earners, you're going to find that some of them are pretty legitimate, that some of them are people who have created new products, such as Google, that a lot of people love and depend on. I use Google every day, and it's very important for my research. So I think that they deserve to be in the top 1%. Apple produces great products, and so they deserve to be in the top 1% because they've created things that are truly magical and truly incredibly valuable for my daily life and for a lot of other people's daily lives. But these huge financial firms, in contrast, they're reaping tremendous gains, and they've got bailouts because they're too big to fail. And, you know, they've got government insurance basically for free, and they're not creating the type of value for the American public. And actually, they're creating that's where the fallout of these business cycles occur. And as a consequence, they get bailed out. And so I think that the whole system is fundamentally flawed, and personally I find it morally repugnant and completely unethical to have a system where a small number of people are favored and who end up reaping tremendous wealth out of the American economy, and they're the ones that are getting basically free government insurance and bailout. So it's an incredible mess, and that's why I think it's the central question that nobody's talking about.
This weekend, I spent, I'm compiling a audio montage of exactly what's happened to our standard of living. I start off with FDR and his Executive Order 6102, you know, where he was going to protect us by basically declaring a felon if you own gold, and he was going to create a government market for gold. From that, I move on to Nixon's breaking of the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1971. Then it moves on into Ben Bernanke and his minions saying that we don't have a housing bubble, to George Bush ignoring free market principles to save the free market with the auto bailouts, to Hank Paulson and them saying just give us a blank check for $700 billion and all of our problems will go away, to QE1, to Operation Twist, to the currency swap program, to QE2, to QE3, to no taper. And, you know, trying to condense that down to about 3 minutes. This weekend, I mean, all we were hearing on the networks was, you know, this need to raise the debt ceiling. And as I pointed out at the start of the show, right now the federal revenues will be equal to what they were just 10 years ago in 2003. And then if we could just, and no one can argue that we had some lean and mean federal government in 2003, that if all we did was take our spending back to 2003, which was a pretty good time economically, we wouldn't need to raise the debt ceiling. And the debate really isn't, you know, how rapidly we raise the debt ceiling and how high, but in my view, don't raise the debt ceiling. In fact, start to lower it. Am I wrong?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm a big advocate of lowering the debt ceiling. And in your montage, you could include the Kennedy's executive order, I believe.
11110.
Yeah, it would permit the Treasury not to issue silver coins in the future, which they quickly took them up on, I believe.
Oh, okay. I'm not as keenly familiar with that one as I am 11110, where he was basically going to resurrect the U.S. note, the red-sealed U.S. note, backed by the silver that was in Fort Knox.
Well, I hadn't heard that. So that whole area is something that needs to be discussed at greater length because, you know, if we still had silver coins, the government would still have shackles on its ability to inflate. And, but that was, as you mentioned, that was taken away after 1964. But yeah, getting back to the question, I'm a big advocate for reducing the debt ceiling. First of all, the government would have to balance its budget. It would have to cut back expenditures further so it could continue to make interest payments on the debt. And then, you know, basically that would force the government to curtail its expenditures back to a level in 2003, which, as you suggest, was not a period of severe austerity in U.S. government expenditures. I mean, we were basically widening the expenses of government up until 2000, and then, of course, government had to expand even further in order to, you know, do things like adjust to the recession of that period when expenditures naturally rise and revenues naturally contract. So there's a lot of areas that could easily be cut back on. You know, the military expenditures were still spend 50% more than all of the rest of the world combined. And there's a lot of operations, overseas operations, that could be curtailed and where you could get expenditure reductions simply by having fewer fleets of the Navy, for example, out on patrol on a regular basis. Then, of course, the National Security Agency just opened a $2 billion facility. They've been opening up multi-billion dollar facilities ever since 9/11. And now they've gotten so big and exorbitant that they're spying on all of us. And so there's a lot of things that are not just unproductive, but they're counterproductive. And they're making the standard of living in the U.S. go downward rather than upward. You know, if we legalized marijuana, for example, and let loose all the nonviolent drug offenders in the United States, that would release hundreds of thousands of people who never committed a violent or property crime. That, for example, would not only cut back expenditures on prisons, which can run $50,000 per year per prisoner, but it's also more labor in the economy so that we could actually produce more goods and services. So when you cut back government, you do a lot of good things in the economy. You can reduce taxes, you can reduce deficits, you can reduce the interest payments, but you can also actually add back in resources into the economy that are could be going forward could be productive. And most economists that you'll hear out there, whether they're Wall Street or Main Street or academic or government, have built into their thinking a GDP fallacy. They think that if we cut the government, and this was on TV all weekend long, basically.
And just this morning as well.
Yeah. If you cut back the government, then that's going to reduce GDP because of the lack of government spending. But see, if that government spending isn't worth anything, or if it's counterproductive, then GDP is not measuring prosperity or standard of living or anything else. And the guys who came up with national income accounting, or GDP, set forth a lot of problems with it as a measure of social welfare. And one of those things was that government spending is something that you can't value by expenditures. And that indeed, because it's not priced by the market, that there's no true economic value that we can be certain about. But what we can be certain about is that a lot of government expenditures are worth very little to the American people. And in many cases, those expenditures are things that produce negative value for the American people. So the George Washington Monument and the expenses that are necessary to keep it open and operating and maintained are probably very much valued by the American public. But that's exactly the type of thing that they shut down during these shutdowns to, you know, get everybody upset and to tick off the American taxpayer. But there's so much of what government does. Tens of thousands of buildings that lie vacant and unused by the government that could be put to good use in the private sector. All the public lands, you know, over 50% of the western states are owned and controlled and basically not used by the federal government. So I think that if we got serious about cutting the government budget, about balancing it, and about reducing the debt ceiling, that would force the government's hand in terms of its resources. It would be forced to turn those resources over to the private sector, and the economy would experience high rates of economic growth. Even if GDP came down in the short run, over the long run, we would all be much better off. I just noticed in the paper today that Italy is, because of austerity measures, is being forced to sell off 50 parcels of government land that include old churches and historical sites, an island off of Venice, that they were using taxpayer money to maintain, that they were allowing those things to degenerate, and now they're going to sell them off to the private sector, who's going to put them to use. I mean, there may be a private residence that goes on that island off of Venice. They may turn some of these churches and historical sites into profitable tourist attractions that will stimulate other businesses in the area. So the GDP fallacy permeates the entire thinking around Washington, D.C., and it's one that we should fight against at every opportunity.
Well, that GDP is probably the most meaningless, most manipulated of the economic statistics. And I think, correct me if you disagree, but one reason the Keynesians came up with GDP was to justify all this wasteful government spending. And what I think we should do is just throw out the GDP and maybe have a private sector version of the GDP where we're only telling what happened in the private sector, since the government can only, it's almost like double counting. If they count it the first time when they're taking the money from us and then count it a second time when they whiz it away, it's double accounting. And the whole reason why they go and spend all this money in times of recession is because they're trying to manipulate that GDP number of theirs.
Oh yeah, they're definitely trying to manipulate it. And you know, Paul Krugman it talks this way all the time, that you have to have greater stimulus spending to raise GDP. Well, you got to look at what they're spending the money on. And Professor Robert Higgs went back and looked at World War II, and he took out government expenditure and he looked at real per capita consumption. So he adjusted for inflation, he adjusted for changes in population, and he looked at consumption by the American people, what they actually consumed, what their standard of living represented. And basically what he found was that real per capita consumption by the American people was actually lower in World War II than it was during the Great Depression. And so when people say, the World War II got us out of the Great Depression, that's also a fallacy that's built upon the GDP fallacy. And it was only after the war was over and FDR was dead and Truman had thrown out the commies out of the Roosevelt administration, and we returned to a gold standard system where the U.S. basically was the world's most powerful military operator and was basically enforcing world peace, did we have a situation where the economy really took off. And, you know, all those millions of men and women who were fighting overseas came home, and the Keynesians thought we were going right back to the Great Depression. But what we saw was an economy that took off, and that real per capita consumption in the U.S. really started to take off at a very fast rate because we had those proper conditions, peace, prosperity, a certain degree of certainty of the U.S., world peace, and a return to gold standard, and a population that had been forced to but had saved a lot of money during World War II, so that it wasn't a great leap of faith that very soon a lot of, you know, there was a lot of family formation, a lot of increase in the birth rate, and new homes were being built and purchased, new automobiles were being built and purchased. And so those are the types of things we want to look at. We want to look at the real things. That's what Austrians emphasize, is the real things and not the fake statistics.
Well, also, too, we had a quite a bit of built-up demand, pent-up demand during the war years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was hard to get a cup of coffee, hard to get sugar. You couldn't find tires to put on your car. And the built-up demand was partly that, partly the fact that Americans had been starved for those particular types of goods, but also I think this is key, is that they also saved a lot of money because they couldn't consume it. And, you know, most of that was in the form of bank accounts and government bonds. But notice that savings is a key ingredient for economic growth, so that entrepreneurs had ample access to capital during those days, whether it was their own business or whether it was bigger forms of business in corporations. Savings is another key to economic growth, and that's something that, of course, the Keynesians also think is wrong. They think that savings is a drag on the economy. They think that consumption is the only thing that matters. Well, you know, the facts are the facts. You have to have savings to start the investment process guided by entrepreneurs that ultimately ends up creating jobs.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Robert Higgs, because I quoted him to start the show. He is, as you noted, an economist. He's with the Independent Institute, and he's the one that pointed out that the revenue right now in this last fiscal year equals all that spending we did back in 2003. Is Higgs a Mises guy as well?
Robert Higgs is definitely a Mises guy. He was somebody who was trained as a mainstream economist and saw the lies of and mistakes of economic historians and drifted in the direction of the Austrian school. And now he is a prominent, revered member of the Austrian school. He comes and speaks at our conference. As a matter of fact, we had a conference here with just him for a week, giving lectures, and those are either available on our website or for sale, about American history. He is, he's not a very optimistic person. He's a very pessimistic person, and his lectures sometimes send you know, give me goosebumps because they're so enlightening and sometimes frightening. But he doesn't pull any punches, and he's a meticulous fact checker, and so you can depend upon his work as being as correct and certainly as honest as anything you'll find out there in terms of American history. He's got a famous book called Crisis and Leviathan, where he explains that government uses crises in order to expand its size. And then after the crisis is over, the government contracts a little bit, but always at a higher level than the previous trend would have set it at. And so he's seen how politicians use crises to expand power, to expand spending in the economy, and then he's got some. He's the guy who, as I mentioned, showed that World War II did not get us out of the Great Depression. He's got some great stuff on the Cold War, the aftermath of World War II. So if you see Robert Higgs on our schedule to be speaking here, I would recommend you coming. If you, you know, go to Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org, and just plug in Robert Higgs, and you can listen to him, you can read him, you can watch him do video lectures, and I think you'll be very, very impressed.
the Peter Schiff show, you're going to get a lot of Austrian economics. And then I'm proud to say that we have added the Tom Woods show to the lineup. So back to back to back.
Well, you got some good ones there, Alan. Peter is, Tom is, you know, definitely, he's an historian, but he's trained himself as an economist, and I think he has a graduate degree in economics as well. Peter Schiff is, of course, a man of the streets. I mean, his father was Erwin Schiff, a great libertarian tax protester who raised him on Austrian economics. And of course, Peter has been applying that, you know, out there in the real world on a regular basis, and it's clear that he sees things through an Austrian lens, and that he's come to the same conclusions that Austrians have come to with respect to the Federal Reserve, the nature of our money, the manipulation of markets, and the instabilities that government has been creating out there. And really, I think one of his most often used word is scam. You know, he correctly sees this as ultimately, you know, you might have some honest people in government, you may have some very well-intentioned people in government, but at some level or another, you've got to just basically admit it, that no matter who made it, no matter who operates it, that the ultimate effect is it's a scam on the part of the moneyed interest against the general public.
Well, your description of Peter Schiff is probably how I came to the Austrian view. I'm not an economist, didn't take economics. It's just when I began to study economics, it was what made the most sense to me. It seemed to be obvious to me that the Keynesians just, I'm against it with every fiber of my existence. And it was the Austrian theory that made the most sense to me as a manufacturer starting at the age of 20, because I mean, it just made the most sense to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you were trained in economics, it's very difficult to throw off the, you know, notions that have been ground into your mind over a multi-year period of time. It was fortunate for me that I didn't get into economics, mainstream economics, until I had already been given a few doses of Austrian economics. So I was able to be on my toes as I was going through this brainwashing process. It made things more difficult, but I think it prevented me from succumbing to this mainstream Keynesian mind-washing system that, you know, basically everybody's under this influence out there, unless you're accessing shows like yours, unless you're going to Mises.org, unless you're listening to the Peter Schiff show, you're listening to the Tom Woods program, you know, you're taking academy courses here at Mises.org and getting the daily articles, where, you know, we were fighting off against this influence of the mainstream media and the mainstream Keynesian economics on the American mind.
Mark, we're almost out of time. I thought you'd appreciate this story. My son, his second semester in college, his first one, he was busy enough to where he kept at it. His second one, he pulled an incomplete on his economics class. And I was saying, well, son, you know, what happened here? And you'll love this, but he goes, well, Dad, the guy was a Keynesian.
Well, what can you say, Alan?
Yeah, I know. I just always found that humorous, that the reason he was skipping that class and it was because the fellow was a Keynesian. So I thought you'd appreciate that. Hey, we've been speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute. That's Mises.org. They have the world's largest collection of economic periodicals, don't you, Mark?
Absolutely. We're the largest amount of content, and almost all of it is completely available for free without registration. And we're also one of the most trafficked economic web pages as well. And we're on Facebook and Twitter as well.
Well, and we're seeing sort of a renaissance. I hate to use that because it's never reached the prominence that it should have. But we are seeing quite the interest in the Austrian theory right now, because clearly the Keynesians got it wrong. It was the Austrians who called this problem well before it happened, predicted the government's response to it, and we see the results. Hey, Mark, Go ahead.
It's going worldwide too, Alan.
All right.
Happy to report.
Well, I appreciate your time.